on Wolf Spirit Radio, everbeyondradio.com, Tear in a Sour from Ireland, Scottish Sovereigns on the Land.ning.com. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond. Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, wherever you are listening on this global broadcast, as it were. Yeah, but it counts, you know, it's global. It might only be like 8 people, you know, but whatever, you know, whatever's going on. Anyway, let me just put the show label on. There we go, we got the label on. And welcome to Ever Beyond. So, happy Easter. Happy Resurrection Day. I know a lot of people like to focus on the old suffering bit, but that's all over now. We've all, I mean, most of the people that I speak to in the sort of presenter group and also in various other groups, you know, soul groups and other interest groups and listeners and everything. Everybody seems to have gone through a horrendous time in the last few days, last few weeks even. And today there does seem to be a kind of lifting of the pressure. And I'm not exactly sure what that's about. My own personal journey that I've shared with some people is it's going to be, I'm probably going to write a book about it. It hopefully may help other people. That's good. I hope. So that's something to look forward to, isn't it? But talking of books, I've been reading a book this last week. It's arrived on my birthday, just before my birthday, and it's something I ordered from Amazon. It's like one of these very kind of self-published books, or you know, small publishers, Rose Dog Books. Where are they? Pittsburgh. Yeah, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. Rose Dog Books. Anyway, Kelsey Bowman. There's a picture of the man there. And who knows who he is? Really? Who the heck knows who the heck anybody is these days? This book, I've just read it out. When I say I read a book, I read it out like I'm getting in touch with my inner grandpa. So this last week is I've been kind of semi-immersed in this this story of intrigue and deception and weird science, and I have to say it's really brought a lot of it all together, and how it matches with the Sands of Time material that Sean David Morton's been publishing in the last few years. And you know, he's in the process of writing the last bit, and perhaps listening to this book might give him some insights to tie up some of these things, because we're basically talking about two sides of the same coin. Those of you who have not heard of Sands of Time, you can come to my YouTube channel, which is Studio 9 Jams, Studio 9 Jam. There might also be a link on my Ever Beyond page, www.everbeyondradio.com. But certainly the audio archives will be there, and somewhere a link to the video archive. But anyway, it was quite popular. It's quite popular on YouTube. It's had a few thousand listeners, and In which Sean is basically outlining the story of the book of Sands of Time, and that, you know, it's not, you know, completely like his own work. It's a dramatization of somebody's journals. So, in this journal, the first person that he meets in the book is a fellow called Hans Kammler, otherwise known as Der Übergruppenführer, which is it's one of those German kind of titles, like Übergruppenführer. Is like it's just such a kind of mouthful of Nazi. That's a whole mouthful of Nazi, you know. It was kind of Nazi. Anyway, what could be worse, you know? Nazis still around, or Nazis with time travel? I don't know which one do you think would be the worst thing, the worst possible case. I'm just going to get to the chat room here. Yeah. So if anybody's got anything to contribute into this particular aspect, I'd love to continue this conversation. So perhaps I'm going to be talking with Sean about it tomorrow night, because having finished the book, I've got a whole other group of chapters to kind of fit in with his side of the story. But essentially, there is a development. First of all, we have a connection with these ladies that we call the Vrildamen. And this is the Vril Society, V-R-I-L. And they called themselves the Vril Society for some reason, because the word Vril is a kind of, it means chi, it's life energy, whatever you call it. It's got a different name in every part of the world. Wilhelm Reich called it orgon, yeah. And other people call it different things, you know, like they call it ki, you know. It's the ki it's the chi of Tai Chi. It's wherever you find the word energy, that's where you'll find this thing. And it, Vril is like a kind of essentially, if you consider what Vril might be, and this is where I get it from somewhere else actually, but the idea of Vril is the combination of extremes and unstable extremes. So, So there are several threads that this thing entails. Number one, this book is about, it seems to be written from the point of view of the man who ran the research establishment itself, the scientist, the head scientist of the Nazi Bell experiment. His name was Rudolf Seeger. He, overseer of, I think he had a team of seven scientists, you know, so it was like, you know, esoteric already, you know. The Vril Society. Now, he went along to a meeting. He was taken along to a meeting of the Vril Society, where there were these. They were presented with the woman who seemed a little older than the Vril Society people had been mentioned, but she seemed to be like the earlier generation of them, like from the 1920s. You know, she was like in her 20s when she was in the 20s, as it were. Anyway, her name was Anna Goethe. My pronunciation during the book, I had to do American accents, I had to do Russian accents, I had to do German accents. They all blurred a bit, you know. Male and female voices blurred a bit, you know. I'm not that good, but I hope you're entertained by it. At least the words are there. So when I'm reading this book and there's all these parallels are being drawn as I'm reading through it, and of course most of the time I'm reading it for the first time, so I'm enjoying it as well as everybody else, and so the newness and the picture of it is kind of shared. We're all in this sense of discovery about it. So it's a really nice thing to read a book for the first time to other people. I used to just fall asleep when I was reading books to my son, which is what I would fall asleep before he did because I was tired after day's work. You know. Anyway. Mm. So that was useless. Meanwhile, back at the Vril Society. So there's a scene in the book right at the beginning, and this is where the Vril Society kind of called him in, and I think this is around 1943, and they've been going for a long time. You know, the Vril people have been going for a long time since the 20s, and they were quite idealistic. They comprise something like they now, and I haven't managed to find any of the names, all of the names of the women, apart from one who is called Maria Orsic, and even her name seems to be, there are various spellings of it, there is various identities of it, and who she was and where she came from. Some people say she was a gypsy, some people say this and that. Anyway, whatever she was. She had hair down to her ankles, and she was stunningly beautiful. There were seven of them, and they were called the Vril Damen, the Vril women. And they would all. Now, here's the thing: those of you who are familiar with the Montauk Project, energies and things like that. Just think, this is where it all came from. This is the stuff that they were getting on with before Paperclip, right? This is why Paperclip. As Sean said, there were something like 750,000 new scientific terms because of the research that the Nazis had did, and these Nazi scientists, they created 750,000 new scientific terms. Imagine knowing all that stuff. Because they researched everything. They researched genetics, they researched the development of the world. There is a massive amount of information that the Nazis had. And part of it was psychic channeled information from a being who we now know from this book as called Anquil. And Anquil is a being from Aldebaran, so he says, and he says he's one of the race of the Sumi. The Sumi, their ancestors settled in the Babylonian area of Ur, and became what we know as the Sumerians, and later the Babylonians. And it seems that Sumerians just seem to have arrived, boom, instant civilization. It just seems to arrive all fully formed, and then kind of gets worse, and then degrades, and does this whole thing, as seem to be a lot of them. And, if you look at the history of America for the last 400 years, that's kind of what's happened. You know, you have all these grand buildings, and now the only things that gets built is like housing slums and houses for rich rock stars or film stars or something like that. So we're looking at a similar placement of that same empire that has existed throughout history. Now, when the Aldebaranians, now let me just explain again for those who are unfamiliar with this night sky. Very familiar to everybody is the famous constellation of Orion. It's famous because it's very easily to identify. It's usually in the night sky somewhere. And it's got this distinctive line of three stars, which for some reason our brains lock onto. It's easy to find these three stars. And it's like two stars in a straight line and then one just slightly off to the left. And as we know, in the Egyptian pyramid complex, you also have something like that, and there are also other pyramids that exist at the point where those stars should be, you know, in terms of the right scale and things like that. So you can also see that that might be where Orion, that's the direction that these people came from. That's why they settled and made an Orion-like imprint on the Earth. So there's Orion in the sky. So if you look at Orion, and you can make out, and it's supposed to be a warrior. So it's a dude with a belt, standing slightly kind of askance, with a sword. There's a kind of line of stars, another line of three or more stars. And if you were pointing a telescope there, you'd see also behind that line of stars the Orion Nebula. Which is kind of inside, sort of beyond where Orion is. There's a nebula beyond that. Above Orion somewhere is Andromeda, indeed. But we're not talking about Andromeda today. We're talking about Aldebaran, right? So if you then look at, you know, zoom out and you see the belt of Orion, you see Orion and you see his knees and his shoulders. His shoulders are on the left of you is Betelgeuse or Betelgeuse. That they say is going to become a supernova any day, so that might kind of light up the night sky. We might not see the rest of this stuff after that. And then also we have, on the other side of Betelgeuse, we have Bellatrix, which is the right shoulder. You know, if you were looking at him, it would be his left shoulder. So, if we then go from Bellatrix, just a bit up and just a bit to the right, you find a line, and there's a bright red star, and then you see the Pleiades about an equal distance away. You recognize Pleiades because you can just about see them, but if you look at them directly, they disappear, and then you look away a little bit, and they reappear. It's a cluster of, you know, ostensibly 7-8 stars. There's about 100 in there, and that's the Pleiades. And the Pleiades is... according to many teachings, the center of our solar system. And the main star in the Pleiades is Alcyone, which is the central star, and it's very much larger than all the others. That's because Alcyone is the center of a solar system that we are spiraling out from. So imagine that that our sun is part of a solar system of solar systems. We need a better word for this. We're like kind of Pluto to the rest of our solar system, which is what we see as the Pleiades. Does that make sense? You got so the Pleiades is like the inner solar system, and we're kind of out on the outer edge of it, which means that we're a much older civilization. Not necessarily civilization, but the star and the Earth is a much older thing than the Pleiades themselves, because they are all young stars from the center of Alcyone. Because my theory is that stars spit out stars, and they start out as planets and evolve into stars. That's my personal theory, and nobody's ever said anything about that, but anyway. Meanwhile... When you have Aldebaran, so yes, we were looking at Aldebaran. So if you look at the night sky, and you've got Orion in front of you, and then up to the right is a bright red star, and then there's Pleiades about the same distance away, that bright red star in the middle is Aldebaran. Finally, we're at Aldebaran. I call it Aldebaran. Here's another thing. All stars begin with AL, don't they? Yeah, that's because AL in Arabic, al, means the. So actually it's like, it's like the Pleiades, or the Deberan, right? Now what does De? De is Daled, is the house. So the house of Ra is my interpretation of the meaning of the word Aldebaran. Okay, so Aldebaran the House of Ra, Deb, being the residence of. Anyway, meanwhile, the door to door, Dalet is door, not residence. Bait is house, Dalet is door. D is the, so it's the doorway. Yeah, the doorway to Ra. Anyway, meanwhile, Aldebaran, these Aldebaranians contact the Vril Society somehow, perhaps one, and they probably said, you know, you need to gather a few in order to get a good aerial. We need to grow their hair so that they got psychic antennas, so that when they take on this this channeling, they've got a good antenna system. Now, I was going back to Montauk because I believe also that during these channeling sessions, the Vrodaman were also, how can I put this, sexually aroused, let's put it this way, by some means. We don't know exactly how, all the records were hidden, but in order for the whole channeling session, the women had to be in a kind of pre-orgasmic state. So, you know, I'm sure the Nazi guys really enjoyed that kind of thing. But what they were talking about was they would give them plans, and they gave them plans in their own language. And this own language turns out to be a runic kind of cuneiform Babylonian script, which was ably translated by the Babylonian experts with the Nazis. So Maria Rosic would be writing this stuff down, and she would be receiving these plans, having no idea what she's doing. I mean, like, no, I mean, conscious idea of what the things mean, but she was taking them down and giving them to the translator. The translator would then give that to the scientists as the plans and blueprints for the ships that they would be building. Okay. Whew. That's the extraterrestrial influence on the Third Reich. Now, let's just go back a bit, because the Vrildamen were quite, in the first place, they were quite idealistic. In fact, you know, most of the Nazis was an idealism. And it resonated with the Aldebaranians because, apparently, I have no personal knowledge of this. This is a story of a story. Mind you, this is all stories of stories, isn't it? I mean, I'm talking about a book, but it might not even be true. But it does tie a lot of things together, as I'm trying to express here. yeah, I hope everybody gets this and that it's making sense. But anyway. Okay, right. There we go. Crash. A flash in space-time. Yes. Yeah, I'm getting flash crashes still. I'm going to have to do something about this radio player business. It's very hard to find a page that doesn't crash. I'm very sorry about this. So, meanwhile. Right. I'm going to have to close my browser here. In fact, yeah, why don't I just, I can, right, since I'm running solo here, I'm just going to reboot my my Skype computer, just so that I have a something clean to work with for the next part of the show. So, okay, so we have the Vrildamen. So the Vrildamen that are channeling this stuff, and they're very idealistic. They're into vegetarianism. They're very much like people today that you would call New Age. Very much. They're into channeling. They're into having long hair. Remember how everybody grew their hair in the 60s? You know? Why? They grew their hair to be more like the American Indians. Why? Because the American Indians had a sense of brotherhood and togetherness, and part of it was part of the hair thing and the feather thing and all of this stuff. So people start wearing hair and feathers and start realizing that they're getting more and more telepathic with each other. So, let me just close that. Yeah. So, with the Vrildaman, they would be receiving instructions in Babylonian and blueprints and plans and diagrams and all sorts of things that would help to create some kind of communication system or craft or something like that that would somehow connect them with Aldebaran. Anyway, this was the beginning of the Vril project, the not the Vril project, but the Bell project. And the Bell in German, the word Bell is Glocke, which is interesting because we probably get our word clock from Glock, because clocks have bells in them, don't they? And they make a clock, clock, clock sound, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, so the Bell. The Bell was a project which was, in a way, it was not exactly a weapon itself. And so for the Vrildaman, they were not too concerned with the fact that the Germans, that the Nazis wanted to create a weapon, because it was basically a means of delivery. It was like a it was like a truck. Now, your truck can deliver vegetables and food, or it could deliver a bomb, you know. It just depends on the intent used with it. And the Vrildaman, as I said, were idealistic, and they wanted to become more like to be the best that a person could be. And again, that's an idealism, and there's nothing wrong with that, is there? To be the best you can be. However, the extraterrestrial Aldebaranian influence was affected by the Aldebaranian concept of what is purity and racial purity and genetic purity. Because here's the thing, and as I say, I don't know this personally, but this is the story that I get about Aldebaran, is that around Aldebaran there are two planets, and on one planet there's a group of people who are what could be called evolved, more evolved. And on the other planet is where all the people that didn't evolve go to. So essentially you have what they call the Übermensch, the over people, and the Untermensch, the under people, that is circling Aldebaran. Now, what that means is that you have a non-equal society. So you have one place where everything is fine and everybody's throwing tennis beach balls at each other and having a lovely time and everything's happy and joyful. And then there's another place which is basically hell. And this is the method of the Aldebaranian. Okay? So what you're talking about is anything that is not perfect must be destroyed or banished. And you can see that that's exactly what happened in Nazi Germany during the Second World War and before, and also what is now starting to happen on our planet. You know, we have these white people who are all enjoying a privileged life, and all the brown people who are not. Basically. Anybody disagree? This is essentially the same doctrine, the same thing. Now, what we're all about is about integration. Bringing the unification, the reintegration of all the parts of us, even the gnarly, not so evolved parts, and giving them a chance to come into the circle and evolve themselves. And I think this is essentially the problem with the whole Nazi attitude. Well, you know, we all know that's the problem with the Nazi attitude. You know, I didn't need to make that my own opinion. I think that we could all agree that the Nazi attitude is if it's not good, if it's not perfect, it should be destroyed. They were ruthless. They remain ruthless. So, world domination. They just want the place to be happy, and they've got a solution. It's hard, isn't it? You know? Democracy. We've got a reason to be happy. We think we've got a solution, so we impose it on everybody. Maybe not everybody wants democracy. Maybe they want their own flavor of freedom. And when you impose your version of freedom on somebody else, like the Nazis were imposing their version of freedom on everybody else. Yeah. Yes, you can join us, or you will die. What a choice. Everybody's got the choice. But not everybody really wanted to die at the time, so they kind of half-heartedly joined them, hoping one day that it will all be over and everybody can go back to being normal and nice again. So, I'm going to put a quick break because I'm doing this all by myself tonight. So, here's one. World Without Love. Welcome back to Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio. This is Ever Beyond. This is JP. And, yeah, today I'm talking about the Nazis, yes, and all this good stuff. It's fascinating because I find it's extremely relevant. From my perspective, the Nazis have not gone away. They've just gone underground. They didn't lose the war. The Germans lost the war. Operation Paperclip just basically let the wolf run the chicken coop. So, meanwhile, so where were we? The Vrildarman. The Vrildarman, Maria Orsic. All right. So here's the thing. They said there were 7 Vrildarman. There are photographs of maybe 4 or 5 of them. There was Maria Orsic. There was someone called Sigrun, another called Heike, another Gudrun, and where was the other one? Sigrun, Gudrun. I think there was one with a B. Anyway, so not all of them have been identified. Their identity has faded. It's very difficult to find anyone apart from Maria Orsic. Now, the bell. Okay, so the bell, die Glocke. The whole thing centered on the bell. It was the focus of what the Aldebaranians wanted to happen. Because what the bell did is to open a portal. Now, the way it did it was by spinning 2 cylinders filled with a isotope of mercury, which the Nazis called Xerum 525, or, as we call it nowadays, red mercury. Red mercury is a very interesting thing. Again, it's been in the news. Google red mercury. See what happens when you Google red mercury. Okay, so the main character of the book meets the Vrildarman when they've been trying to work on anti-gravitational craft. Okay, now anti-gravitation, it's as I've been instructed by my insider William Stillings, that anti-gravity is not it's not the right way to put it. He says gravity is a wave. And so basically, you actually create gravity. And you create gravity by counter-rotating, spinning electromagnetic fields. What does that mean? It means that you take... okay, so you charge up a disc. You charge it up with a Van de Graaff generator. Do you know what a Van de Graaff generator is? One of those things that you got in the school lab. It's got a big... the dome at the top, big spherical dome of steel. So it's like a big steel ball, and then there's a kind of rubber belt that goes up underneath it, and somehow the rubber brings up electrons, and they're taken up by the bell at the top. And so the dome at the top charges and charges and charges until somebody walks past, because the path to Earth is shorter to the person who's walking past than it is to go back down to the base of the thing. So what they used was they would charge a disc electrostatically. This is called electrostatic, the static electricity Van de Graaff generator. And you can get millions of volts out of this stuff. I mean, really, really, lots. And so they were using Van de Graaff generators to charge up counter-rotating spins. Now, counter-rotating basically means you got one disc spinning clockwise and one disc spinning anti-clockwise. It's exactly what you do in your Merkabah meditation. If you do that in, if you imagine a Merkabah and you have one tetrahedron that spins one way and another one spins the other way, and you can hold that in your mind. Send me an email if you do in your meditations and tell me what happens. Meanwhile, yeah. So meanwhile, we're looking at the Vril Dharman and their connection. So in the belt, the Glock, the book, the main character, Rudolf Seeger, he goes to the Vril Dharman and he meets with Anna Goethe, and she goes into a trance and starts channeling this character called Anquil. Anquil is the Aldebaranian man, being, person, thing, who has been instructing them how to build the Vril craft. And he says, "Bring Seeger to me." So Seeger comes along and says, "Hello," because he's talking to this woman who's in a trance, who's now speaking with a great big boomy voice instead of her little kind of squeaky German voice. So she's this voice is coming out, and they're discussing, how is the project coming along? And then the guy's going, okay. So we're having trouble getting enough energy out of the electrostatic charges from the Van de Graaff. You need to use something stronger. You need to use Vril. And so he says, What do you mean, Vril? He says, it's different on every planet, says Anquil. You have to find an unstable isotope of a ferromagnetic fluid. So he remembers that. Oh, what the heck does that mean? It probably means as much to him at the time as it does to you right now. An unstable isotope of mercury that is a supermagnetic ferrofluid. Well, what does that mean? It means it's magnetic. So mercury, if you took regular mercury and put a magnet near it, nothing would happen. However, if you make a ferrofluid, by somehow combining mercury and maybe iron filings, for instance, finely ground iron, and you can, again, Google this, you can see ferrofluid and superfluids and magnetic liquids, and that's what they used. Now, they... So he is speaking to this extraterrestrial from Aldebaran, he says, "I really don't know what you're talking about." And he says, and Anquil is kind of fading away, and just as he's fading away, he goes, "Red Mercury! Red Mercury! Ah, Red Mercury, what the heck's that?" So, but he remembers all this. Anyway, so he goes back to his meeting with Der Obergruppenführer, Hans Kammler. Okay? Kammler is the, as he said, Obergruppe leader. That's what Obergruppenführer, Obergruppe leader. He says to him, you know, I didn't understand the hell what these witches were talking about. They were just talking about stuff like, you know, red mercury. What do you mean? What does he mean by that? And Kamala's jaw dropped the floor, because another branch of scientific research that was being done by the classic German Nazi scientist crazy man, Werner Eckert. Werner Eckert is this crazy man who what they call the X division, the X sciences, you know, like the X Files, weird scientists. Now, what is it they call it in the FBI? I'm trying to remember it. It's something like WSAFM. WSAFM. Yeah, that stands for Weird Science and Freaking Magic. Except it's not freaking. Anyway. So, meanwhile, I just want to connect back with the chat room. My machine crashed earlier. I'm just trying to get back with the chat room here so I can see if anybody's actually interested in what I'm talking about. Welcome back. Also, I have a new chat room experiment that is at wallspiritradio.com/listen. So I have a new thing. So hello, Beach 333. Hello, everybody. So meanwhile, back in 1943, we're talking with with Hans Kammler is talking with Rudolf Seeger, who is the leader of the scientific Bell project. And basically, they're working on electromagnetic rotating fields, which creates gravitational effects, including what's known as anti-gravity, i.e. levitation. So they bring all this stuff together. Kammler is in charge of all of these different projects because... All right, so back to... I know I'm jumping around a bit. It's there's a lot of different parts of this. Okay, Hitler. Hitler. Meanwhile, it's Hitler. Yeah, So, Hitler is also talking with these Vrildarmen and is speaking about stuff, about using a wonder weapon. You know, they give Hitler a design for a wonder weapon, and they give these different people different parts of the project, so nobody knows exactly what it is. The wonder weapon, Wunderwaffe. Yeah, that's what they called it, Wunderwaffe. And the nature of it were the well, basically, Werner Eckert was the guy who was creating the weapons. Literally, he was the originator of the weapons of mass destruction program. And if anybody's seen Doctor Strangelove, you could probably just about expect that Strangelove was Eckert. Or someone like him. Because he was working on this material, and he called it XERUM, Serum 525. This material has all these very interesting properties. And how to make it? Well, he's been experimenting on these tiny amounts, you know. And you have to basically boil iron filings in high pressure, you know, 200,000 atmosphere, high temperature, 8,000 degrees, mercury. You know, you got to boil mercury. And you add stuff like iron filings and thorium and a bit of this and a bit of that and ears of Newton, eye of toad and stuff. And you basically come up with this substance, which is a ferromagnetic fluid, which is the exact properties of the vril. It's the stuff that they were looking for. So kind of concurrently, this guy Eckert has been developing this stuff. Now, so the first time we meet Eckert, you know, he's got all these this experiment going, and he exposes a bit of this stuff to various organic materials, let's put it that way. It, you know, turns it to black goo. It's disgusting. It's horrible. What happens when, you know, you activate this stuff? It is the stuff, you know, it's worse than a nuclear weapon. Anyway. So there were basically four different kind of weapons of mass destruction that Eckert was developing. One of them was an atomic weapon. Yeah, much like what the Americans were describing. And you know what? Now, again, according to this book, Hitler decided not to use that one because it was too brutal. Yeah, I know. Why don't they let Hitler have vodka? Because it makes him mean, you know. I don't know, whatever. But is there a cheaper recipe for red mercury? Well, here's the thing. Red mercury is, as you say, it's a vast amount of energy to produce it, and it's basically, it costs something like $6 million to create 100 grams of this stuff. You know, somebody want to do a Google search for red mercury, you know, how much does it cost? Because, as we heard before, it's an unstable isotope of mercury. It releases energy. And if you spin it at high pressure and you add a bit of juice to it, it will then start to produce this incredible polarity between the two halves of the spinning object. So basically what they did, they had a cylinder, like a toroid, I think, probably, like a donut, you know, a liner. They would have two cylinders, and they would fill each one with about 1.5 tons of red mercury. Okay, so, by the way, remember how much that just cost? Yeah, 1.5 tons of red mercury. So we're talking billions. This is why... research is so, you know, this is why there's a huge military-industrial complex cost, because they're creating this stuff, this red mercury. They're making it. They've probably got underground bases that are boiling this stuff away as we speak. And this is the material that goes into your later developments of the TR-3, you know, the triangular spacecraft. So, red mercury. So, the other very intriguing, and this comes in later, factor of red mercury is that if you make a batch of red mercury, each atom of that red mercury is quantum entangled with each other. Therefore, if you take one batch, split it into half, and use one of them to create a portal, then the other lot will start creating portals too. And Eckert knew this. And so when they were doing tests on the Bell, he had a secondary machine that was also firing up, doing other probably quite nasty things. So, and again, you got to imagine, Eckert is Dr. Strangelove. He's a crazy German Nazi scientist, you know, leaping around with a high squealy voice. Uh-huh. You want to make it with S-port. Right. Well, here's... You know, this is the thing. When they fired up the bell, something went wrong. The first time they fired it, something terribly went wrong. They had a spy. We find out who the spy is later. But they had a spy who tipped off the location of the test site where the bell was going to be tested. And this is the place they called the Henge. Anybody who's seen Stonehenge, anybody's actually been there, like me, you know, they're about 20 feet high. Not as impressive as you think. However, this henge was impressive. I think there are about 150 feet columns. And this is all to, and it was all camouflage, you know, people wouldn't bump into the thing, it was so camouflage. But anyway, in the middle of these columns, they had these enormous hook, loops bolted into the concrete, and titanium chains that were on great big, a winder thing, you know, so they could wind them up and let them out. What do they call them? A pulley. Is that a pulley? Hang on the sewing machine it's called a bobbin. I've lost the word. Anyway. But anyway, a great big winding thing that winds up the chain. Anyway, in the midst of this, they would place the bell. The bell was about 15 feet high. It was made of titanium and steel. And essentially, if you look at the Dalek, it looks like a Dalek. You know, more or less. Anyway, in the bell there were these two cylinders that would counter-rotate. And inside the cylinders were red mercury. So they did the first test. And Colonel Martin Bormann, our famous Martin Bormann, is on the scene. There's Kamla and Seeger and all the crew, and they're all there, and they're in this place overlooking the Henge. They've got a kind of observation platform with the steel shuttered doors and stuff. So they look down, and they can see down onto the plane. There's the Henge, the thing in the middle. So they fire the thing up, and it starts emanating a bluish glow, and they start off at 5%. Okay, turn up 10%. And the thing starts wobbling a bit. Okay, 15%. It starts wobbling and then it starts lifting off the ground. Okay, it's chained by these titanium chains. And Bormann comes along and says, "Oh, come on, stop pussyfooting around, crank it up." So he said, "Okay, turn it up to 30%. Well, it's 30 or 40%, anyway. Whatever it was. It started getting unstable at that point. It rose up. It was pulling on the chains. And all sorts of weird lightning started happening. There was lightning going off at Eckert's lab. All sorts of weird things were going. And just at that time, a bomber came along to try and attack the installation, because it had been tipped off by the spy. The bomber got caught in the gravitational vortex. You know, as if things weren't bad enough, as if Nazis didn't have anti-gravity, they pulled this thing, and this thing flew into the bell. A bomber flew into the bell that was kind of floating above the ground, but it was creating such a kind of vortex. It was pulling the thing in. Shock waves would demolish all the trees around it. It was a real mess. And the last few seconds, when they observed it, the last few seconds happened in slow motion. They saw the plane very slowly crumple into the site of the bell. They tried to turn it off, but it wouldn't go off. So, that was the test of the bell. And I believe that that's the first time that the time-space fabric has been torn. And that's the beginning of the the problem that was exacerbated by the Philadelphia experiment. So, I have found a good track. This is Van Halen. This is called Unchained. Remember those titanium chains, people? Unchained by Van Halen. Welcome back to Ever Beyond. Well, Nazis with anti-gravity. What could go wrong? Well, as we heard, who is this? 21. Adding all these people. Yeah, what that all about? I don't know. Spam? I'm not having all. Good Lord. Good Lord. What the heck? Anyway, sorry, I've just got this strange Skype message that I am going to. Somebody's done something here. Who is Tim? Anyway, we'll find out. Yep. I don't know what that's all about. Anyway, we'll find out later. Yeah, right, so, where were we? Edward Leedskalnin. Yes, very, very interesting. Very, very interesting, Leedskalnin. Anyway, meanwhile, it's 1943, and the Nazis are experimenting with the Nazi bell, die Glocke. Okay, so the first experiment, as we saw, was a total disaster. Aside from things going very weird, they lost a lot of their scientists because some of them were down by the henge observing what was going on, and they got hit by a flying shrapnel from the exploding aircraft. And some were, you know, just demolished, crushed by the force of the shockwave that came off the bell. Various things happened, you know, with glow and various things. So it would glow. Yeah, it would glow, it would lift up in the air, lightning would be everywhere. It was, you know, it was your real classic Nazi time machine experiment, you know, out in the open, in the henge, with a mountain overlooking it, and it was, you know, it was a complete disaster. And one of the scientists on Seeger's team, whose name was, I think his name was Andrew, Andrea probably, he was killed by the shrapnel, and it deeply affected a lot of them for, but, you know, there was such an excitement about what the thing actually did when they did fire it up, that they said, you know, this is true, it really does what it does. So build another one. Make me another one, because we got 6 months to win the war. They knew the Allies were approaching, and the Allies were probably going to get there in about 7 months at that time. However, that did become a shorter amount of time, and it did coincide. Everything came together. You know, at the end of the book, the whole thing comes together. It was an Allied plane that they'd been tipped off that there would be a test event. It was a bomber. There would be a test event at this place at this time. You know, she gave the coordinates and the space time. It was a regular Allied bomber. But that it got caught in the vortex. It got sucked down out of the sky. It was going to bomb the place, but it got sucked down out of the sky into the Glock, into the vortex that the Glock had produced. So it's a real tragedy for everybody. You know, we lost the bomber and also lost this the bell. So after they recovered, the top brass in the Nazis, you know, they saw that this, you know, this is kind of, you know, it was good. You know, it did what they wanted to do, you know, get it fixed up, make it work, and give us another one of these in 6 months' time. And this was the time that the Allies were, you know, approaching Germany. You know, the war didn't finish for a couple of years after that because of the Japanese and everything, but this was about the time when, you know, D-Day was June 1944, when they stormed Normandy and started marching across Europe. And we're talking about, you know, the test was going to happen about August 1944, I think, or thereabouts. So they then start with a smaller version of the bell. They do a kind of mock-up. They do a little baby bell. And they get this made, and they run a test. And this one also has navigation. So they can steer it, you know, can tilt it, and therefore make it spin in a different direction. So they've then got a kind of basic remote controller. And the second test, not only is Martin Bormann and Obergruppenführer present, but also the Führer himself, Adolf Hitler, is present at the test. So they start slowly. up to 5%. You know, they've balanced it out a bit. They've got the thing working, and the baby bell rises up in the air, keeps rising, and then once it's you know, it's about sort of 20% it's up in the air. It's about, you know, 50 feet above the air, and they say, okay, make it go left, and, you know, move to the left, and make it go right, and move back to the right center. Okay, push the joystick a bit harder, make it move faster. And it started moving to the left, and then suddenly it disappeared, but it simultaneously appears several hundred meters away. It literally disappears and reappears in another place. And everybody's looking at each other going, "Ooh, that's interesting." He said, "Okay, do the same, but come back." And again, it disappeared and reappeared back where it's back at the place where it started. So what they discovered there was, this is a dimensional craft. It's moving out of space-time and coming back in again. And then they powered the thing down, and then they chained it up. And when they chained it up, they cranked it up all the way. All the way, 100% power. This thing was whining. I mean, you know, the power is the amount of spin that the counter-rotation is creating. It made a horrific sound, and then a green glow appears out of it, and then lightning and kind of a whole bunch of fireworks, and then it's gone. And everybody's gone, "Where's it gone?" And the guy who was on the navigation and is tracking it says, "Still here, sir." And again, they looked at each other. They said, "Okay, let's power it down." They powered it down back to 20%. Lightning, green light, it appears again. Hitler has one thing to say. You know, so that's the end of that experiment. Hitler has one thing to say. He just says under his breath, "Those witches were right." Never said another word. Goes away. So that's the second test of the Nazi bell. Somewhere in there was the beginning of a tear in space-time. Anyway, about 3 months later than that, having tested the bell and managed to build a new one. Oh, the other thing is that when they examined the surface of this craft, having been spending, you know, like 20 minutes or, you know, a couple of hours maybe doing all this stuff, they looked at the surface and it was weathered, it was rusted, it was a complete wreck. It just, you know, it was totally destroyed. As if it had been 100 years old. Gringo, yes. So Philadelphia experiment was the next experiment after that. Well, actually, it's probably about the same time, isn't it? Well, 1943. So these are all happening at the same time. I'm pretty sure that the bell and the it goes like the first bell, Philadelphia experiment, then maybe the second and third bells. Anyway, the third time the bell is run was virtually the day that the Allies were arriving. And General Sporenberg, who was the head of the head, he was, you know, just below the Führer. He was the guy that made sure that Nazi secrets were kept safe in only the way, in that peculiar and specific way that the Nazis like to keep secrets. With a Luger, I think it was, you know, they would shoot people, they'd kill people. He was tasked with basically destroying the entire Bell project. So it brings in a load of troops. It's quite an exciting ending, I have to say. You know, the last couple of chapters really do get going in an action way. It's, you know, there's a lot going on. But the final thing is that the bell is, just as Sporenberg is trying to kill everybody, Seeger and his partner, known as Helga Vellum, are seen escaping because they powered up the bell, got inside, and were gone. And that was the last time that Rudolf Seeger and Helga Vellum were seen in Germany that day. So the bell upped and disappeared. Now, those of you who have had any connection with UFOs and MUFON and all this stuff will know of a very, very famous sighting that happened in Kecksburg, Philadelphia. According to this book, that sighting of Kecksburg, Philadelphia, was the point in space and time that the bell reappeared in the sky over Philadelphia, gradually coming to a landing, and there was a farmer present and various other military people present. Eventually, the bell, the door. That's right. They picked the bell up and, you know, put it on the back of a lorry and took it back to Area 51 or wherever they were, or wherever it was, you know, Edwards or whatever Air Force base they put this thing to. And once they had it in the hangar and everything had cooled down, it was super hot. Once they had it in the hangar, they hear this big and the bell doors open up, and climbing out first of all was a pair of Nazi boots followed by the legs, arms, and rest of the body of Rudolf Seeger. Our world's first time-traveling Nazi, Rudolf Seeger. Amply entertained, amply followed by his erstwhile lover, Helga Wilhelm. There was one person who was there, and he was a paperclip scientist who had been brought over after the war, and he was the only remaining scientist from the Bell, the only living scientist. All the rest had been killed, but the castle where they were had all these secret passages. I mean, it's a real classic Gothic kind of castle, with all the secret passages and tunnels and pathways, and they just expanded them to make the underground bases where they were doing all the work. And well, that should be interesting. The two of them step out of the Bell, having it, you know, it was a UFO, but the two people, humans, Germans, literally had just stepped from 1944 into 1965, I think it was. And at the time, Otto was a paperclip scientist, and he immediately ran up to them and recognized them and embraced them, and it was like, you know, reunion of old friends. And of course, Seeger recognizes at once that he's in the future. And you have to understand that Seeger has just been on a homicidal rampage, because he knew Sporenberg was going to kill everybody. And he wanted to rescue Helga because she had been the spy, and Sporenberg had sprung her had pointed to her and recognized that she was the spy. And so, long story. You should hear the book. Listen to the book. It's a great story. But anyway, there's Rudolf Seeger and Helga. So what they do is they actually go back in time using the Bell. They fire the Bell back up again and go back in time and create a portal, go through the portal, and the portal opens in Werner Eckert's laboratory, where is standing Hans Kammler and Werner Eckert, who throws Kammler into the mechanism, rapidly spinning mechanism, which essentially splatters him all over the laboratory walls. But just then, out of this portal that appears, this kind of, you know, blue light kind of portal, out appears the figure of Rudolf Seeger, who murders Werner Eckert, the mad scientist, puts a dagger through his skull, you know, the mad scientist thing, and then disappears back through the portal. This is because in the future, out by Area 51, there is a large, growing, blue, sparkly rift in space and time that the scientists had estimated that it would, in 24 hours it would have engulfed the whole state. It was rapidly growing. So they had to close that portal. And that's what he did by going back and murdering Eckert, causing his machine to explode, and then he went back into the future. So there are our time-traveling Nazis who then appear in 1965, who also later on appear in the moment when Otto, the scientist, is in hospital. And this is the last chapter in the book, is a kind of newspaper report kind of story, or a newspaper reporter story, about Otto and what he told the reporter. And on the moment of his death, just the day of his death, he is visited by a man and a woman who somehow seem familiar. I mean, the journalist is sitting in the cafe, and he sees this couple walk in into the hospital. And it kind of vaguely stirs something in him. He didn't quite get it. But then Otto had a photograph of the team as they were before they were just about to start the Bell project, and he recognized them from that photograph. And after Otto dies, while the guy's in the hospital, he goes up and goes to the room and says, "You know, I left my stuff here. Can I get it?" And he picks up his journal with the photograph in it, with freshly written on ink. Let me just see if I can find the exact wording of this. Freshly written in ink. All right. There we go. I'll just read that last part. "I open the small leather book. In doing so, the old tattered photo falls and twirls to the ground. I bend at the knees and crouch to retrieve it. Staring back at me is the back of the photo. I noticed, written in black ink and an almost calligraphic style handwriting. Perfect, if you ask me. Definitely a woman's. I stand, bring the back of the photo and the writing into view, and begin to read out loud. Tell our old friend's story. Yours truly, Rudolf Seeger and Kitty Waters. P.S. Hitler never died. He just hasn't shown up yet." The most amazing fact of these words were not just that they were on the photo, but a date was left in the same handwriting and ink, still fresh by the evidence of smudges. It was today's date, like right now. Impossible. So, that was the last message that the Nazi time travelers gave to this other guy, and it was probably something like 1985 that was the okay. Let me just check, see if I can find the actual date of the of this reporter's chapter here. Right. So there's Sporenberg. Sporenberg got caught by the Russians. And he gets interrogated and then befriended by a Russian admiral who extracts as much information out of him as possible that was then shared with everybody. So I'm just trying to find the date when Otto dies, which is, yeah, interestingly enough, the room was room 525, which had this interesting little connection with serum 525 or red mercury. Okay, so that's about the story of Die Glock, and how it then connects is that in the sands of time, there's this couple who appear. And this couple is a tall, thin man and a beautiful woman. And they are named as Simon Ratterman and Anne something like Anne Taylor, I can't remember. Anne, but just an ordinary sounding name. And from what I can understand, what I can see, as this is the same couple. These are the time-traveling Nazis. They have the bell. There's only one bell. They've got it, and they are traveling somewhere in space and time. They also have a connection with the father of Ted, who is the United States scientist who was working on the space program and the secret government for 40 years, from about 1960 to 1998 or something like that. So, right, so I'm right, so that concludes that little section. I'm interested in anybody's feedback, so I'm just going to put a tune on and see if anybody's anybody's interested. Let's see, if what should I put? Oh, I'm trying to think of something nice to put on. Well, let's start with this, the Finland song. Oh yeah, says Fat Reg from Pinner. Drifts off into the galaxy. It might be a long, long time. Yes, indeed. And here we are, back on Ever Beyond. We've been talking about time-traveling Nazis, and my guest tonight, my psychic sidekick, and psychic investigator, Nancy Hopkins. Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I don't know if I'm any of those things, but I am a great fan of yours. I love your stories.
So, you heard some of this. How much of tonight's show did you get?
Oh, I heard it all.
Okay, so
yeah, I was listening to the whole thing.
Good, good. So, first of all, what's your impression of the story? How did it touch you at all? Is there something? Oh. Were there points in there?
Well, anybody that knows about Pennsylvania knows that this thing looked identical to the bell. I mean, I don't remember his name, but there's been some reporter there for decades has been, telling people, what happened was that a lot of people saw it. People actually went down close enough to be able to see some kind of almost hieroglyphics on it. It was in the shape of like an acorn. It definitely crashed. It wasn't you wondered about if there was anybody in it, how the hell they got out of it, because it came down through the trees and everything. There was damage all over the place, and before anybody could really react, there were military people all over the place. And that was what I always found interesting, is how fast they got there. And is that an indication that they half expected it to be there?
Absolutely.
That was one of the things that, I mean, they get there fast anytime, but this was 1960, like you say, five, I think. And how fast that they were actually on the ground and getting people out of it there. But there's no doubt that it didn't actually look like what we've come to know as the Bell. So from the get-go, you have to assume that it was some kind of a time thing, because, it showed up in 65. But now, the book itself, is it presented as a novel? Is it presented as somebody, writing the history of it? How was that presented? What's the tone of the novel or the book?
It's described as a fast-paced action thriller. But it's a story. He says he's a storyteller. However, much of the, all of the information ties in, nails down, completely connects in Sands of Time and other stuff that I've been investigating. It totally fits in. There doesn't seem to be very much fat in this, if you see what I mean.
Well, just because it might be presented as a novel or fiction does not mean that it's not absolute truth. Even like when I did the 9/11 Crusade, which was a novel, it was all, I took all the research that I had and I put it out in front of me and I said, okay, so give me a storyline that will connect all these different facts that I really wanted to get across to my audience. But the actual story that was written was like told to me. You know, is that channeling? Is that just some imagination that you pulled all these things together? I mean, I don't know that it's imagination when you're going like, oh, really? That happened? Okay. You know, and maybe this person who actually wrote the book was, you know, knew his research, knew how it tied in. I mean, there's a lot of information that is out there that somebody could pull together to tie this all together. But maybe it was even more than that. Maybe he somehow or another was an incarnated one individual that was actually there, that's actually remembering. We don't know the limitations of the human creative mind. But it all resonated with me. I wouldn't argue with any of it. I love the thing about taking the plane out of the in the vortex, though, and just sort of it sucked right down into the bell.
Yeah, it sucked it right down into the vortex that the bell produced, which was in the middle of the henge, and so the plane basically crashed into the henge. Didn't seem to hurt the henge. It was very sturdily built. Let's put it that way.
And the bombs didn't go around the plane?
Presumably, whatever the plane was sucked into took the explosion, if there was any.
Interesting.
You know, it was one of
the... Well, you know, you mentioned something. You mentioned a green glow and the lightning. That was the same effect they had at the Philadelphia experiment.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, there was a moment further back in the book when they talk about the Nazi spies had been watching Project Rainbow, which is Philadelphia experiment. So they, you know, these things were going on at the same time. They've been As with all of these mysteries, getting the chronology right is tricky. But we know that...
Well,
especially
when you're dealing with time.
Yeah, especially when you're messing around with time.
Time shifts. You know, time is an illusion. It's just a relationship of place and space. So it can just shift on you. I mean, there's nothing to say that, you know, I'm going to go to June 24th, 1948, because that doesn't exist. Are you going to go to exactly the place and position that Nancy Hopkins was born in? Yes, you can do that. But to actually go back and specificize a time? Nah, I don't think it could be done. Doesn't make sense to me. You know what I'm saying?
So the green glow seems to be an effect, and it says it's a mist. It's like a green mist.
That's exactly what's described about the ship.
Exactly.
Eldridge, that was sitting, you know, was sitting there, and when they turned on the degaussers, which are huge, again, you're using electromagnetic.
Yeah.
And it's a huge electromagnetic device that just puts out this huge field, and when they put it out, I believe it was a clockwise green mist. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But there was definitely a green mist that started swirling around the ship before it disappeared.
And so we're seeing, but the thing is, the green mist, right? So the mist, this is interesting, because when we think of electricity and electromagnetism and things like that, we think of maybe straight lines, you know, and lightning bolts and things like that, but we don't think of this nebulous mist. But this nebulous mist we see out in space, and they say, oh yes, that's plasma. Plasma, we ask.
Precisely.
What's plasma? You know? Oh, well, it's a mist. It's a green mist. That's the fifth state of matter? The fifth state?
Gaseous, solid, liquid. It's the fourth, I think.
It corresponds to fire, doesn't it? I mean...
I think it's the fourth.
Yeah. Well, whichever one it is, it's the one that's missing from our reality in terms of behavioral properties. It doesn't behave the same as all the other elements, as all the other states of matter. You know, it doesn't seem to kind of pour. You know, it doesn't seem to have an attachment to gravity. Yeah, maybe because it's made of gravity and it's, you know, gravity's doing stuff. Anyway, it's very complex. Let's just back slowly away from the green mist for a second.
Well, if you think of plasma, I've wondered about these globes that they see in pictures lately. Well, not lately, but I mean, the more orbs. Cameras are out there, the more they see these globes. Orbs, I'm sorry. And I've often wondered what this substance of the orb was, and it's actually crossed my mind. Is it some kind of a light plasma effect of some kind of an energy that's just sort of moving through the area?
Well, what's the difference between plasma and photons, Nancy?
I'm not sure. I don't know that I could make it up if you want.
Well, look, what we're talking about, you know, we're talking about plasma. We're talking about a highly energetic state of being, you know, state, a highly energetic elemental state.
Okay. Well, I don't think that, yes, in its energetic state is what it is. I think that when you see a plasma effect of anything, that you're going beyond 3D material, in that this plasma is reacting in a everything material is operating below the speed of light. That's why it looks solid to us. Plasma is like on the edge between things, and very much I would think linked to the quantum energy, that it's almost, you haven't gotten to a material state. You've probably gone out of a material state into a, you know, the fraction of an instant when the energy from the quantum element is then solidified into a frequency lower than the speed of light. Because when you see the plasma, it has a kind of a spooky kind of frequency to it. If you've just seen it on, in a film or something, it's like you can't get your handle on it. You know, it's just this moving stuff, and to me, it always felt like it was just on the edge of between quantum and material. That's just my feeling on it. Now, so at that point, you wouldn't really have a proton; you'd have proto energy moving into a proton state.
Okay, now photons.
Or in an atomic state.
Photons. Because one of the things that, now I can't remember who did the experimentation, but basically I think it was Japanese scientists, they set up a highly sensitive photocell in a very, very, very dark place, and they got somebody to remote view it. And when the person was reporting that they were remote viewing it, they were reporting photons appearing at this place. Now,
yes.
This other thing that you talk about, the orbs, I have for many years, and I think many people will report this, have seen little, I call them like little packets. Little packets. Sometimes they're a kind of white, sometimes they're blue, sometimes they're pinkish. But they're like a little spark that just seems to go off, just seems to happen in front of me. Now, I imagine that if I was a camera, and I was looking through this, perhaps it's the aura of the person who is observing, extending in front of the camera, and producing tiny flashes that are very close to the lens, because they're in your body aura. You understand? That's what would come out as, if it's very close, it would come out really blurred. So what I think is that the orbs are not far away from the camera. They're not over there. They're right up close. What do you think of that?
I've seen some orbs that were very, very clear, to the point that you actually could see an image inside the orb. One time there was a face of a wolf in the orb, and it was absolutely stunningly clear. It was big, and it was surrounded by other orbs.
Well,
I've seen them with
That's happened as well. I have one picture I took, it was maybe about 8 years ago, and it's my girlfriend at the time bred puppies, and she had two baby beagles. They were enormous. I think one of them was called Frosty, anyway. But he appears to be looking at this orb, right, that is on the other side of the photograph. And when I look at the photo, when I expand that little piece of the photograph where the orb is, it appears to have a little doggy face. It looks like a little doggy face. So who knows what was going on there? And who knows what these things are? But I think these are like little flashes of plasma.
It would fit, well, like I say, to me, when I've seen them, I wondered it, because it's just... And it would make sense from the standpoint that the human being there can't see it because it's not in the 3D below speed light yet. But a camera that's working digitally that isn't so defined by time, you know, about speed of light thing, could just catch it because it's coming into 3D. It's just outside of what human beings can see, but the camera can see a little more. So it makes sense to me.
Mm. And at the same time, I think, many years ago, I used to say, I hear this. I hear tinnitus. You know, I got this, lots of them, lots of sounds in my head. And I also see these little flashes everywhere when I'm kind of relaxed, when I'm not looking. You see what I mean? Not sort of looking at anything. When I'm not looking at anything in specific, that's when I start seeing these things. And they seem to be, like I say, they seem to be connected with your connectedness. Like, the more connected you are, the more these sparkles appear. So perhaps they're an example of your own sparkly nature. Literally, you're sparkling around you. And your camera is just is behind that field. It's like it's on the surface of the planet looking through the atmosphere, and the sparkles are going on in the atmosphere, kind of thing.
But you're only seeing them associated with you. You're not seeing them in other people?
Well, I mean, when you take photos and there's people in the picture, they do seem to have these other ones. Now, we used to do a big experiment back a few years ago with the chat room group in Rebecca Jernigan's show. And... she used to play some music in the middle, and we used to go over to Donna Spratt's garden, and she would take photos, and we would kind of dance around in her garden to the music, and she would take photos, and we would try to express ourselves as a sort of color or symbol in the orb that she was taking. That was quite an interesting experiment.
What was the conclusions?
It seemed that when we were invited over there, she would photograph more orbs. Quite interesting, isn't it?
Well, again, was it that she was photographing more orbs that was showing up in her own aura, or was she seeing your orbs also?
Who's to say? Because we were connecting in through her as well, weren't we? I didn't know exactly.
It comes back to that group soul thing. You know, what comes first? Is there some group soul out there that, you know, could have been dominating so that it was the group soul orb that she was seeing? Because there's more of it.
Probably. Very, you know, that's quite possible. It was an interesting experiment, and you know. I don't know if we got any conclusions from it, but it's certainly an interesting thing to do. It was quite fun. Mm. So, time-traveling Nazis and rips in space-time. So, do you remember, we used to talk about rips in space-time from the Philadelphia experiment. You remember we were talking about that?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you think that this bell... information is anyway able to help with that?
Well, you know, God only knows how many whips there are, because who knows who's trying to do the same thing in some lap. I mean, Walt and I were playing on the chat thing about, you know, well, what's this red mercury? You know, can we make it, you know, in a different way? Can you do this? Can you do that? Well, there's, you know, millions of people out there doing the same thing with their heads. So who knows? Maybe we make little rips in time all the time. We don't know. I mean, but when they get to the, you know, nations like the CERN thing. I'm sorry, CERN is a really nasty, dangerous thing they're doing. You know, they can give you a lot of reasons for it, but they're dealing in forces of nature that honestly I don't think the human brain can comprehend. And it's like, well, why'd you climb the mountain? Because it was there. Well, why did you build this? Because we could. They don't have any damn good reason for building this. They just are, you know, I think that the black side is trying to create some kind of a super vortex, move the planet, do whatever they think they're going to do. And it's as crazy as you can take science fiction. I guarantee you a human mind has already thought of that as being a potential reality. You know,
Dr. Strangelove is real.
Yeah, I am convinced. It has to be. You know, because it's just the nature of energy, universe, and thought. You know, which comes first? You know, the person that's doing it or the person that is trying to imagine it? You know, I mean, it just all these things. Where do they come from? What starts an imagination? Because if people don't use their imagination, they don't know how amazing it is. And I got really lucky when I was a kid. I had a paper route, and I had to be an hour and a half going around this, dropping papers off and on a bicycle. And so I started just making up stories in my head. You know, it was better than television. And so it's just exercising your imagination so you can actually, you know, think outside the box and imagine what could be. But so many people with the continual input of just information, they don't have time to use their imagination. But there are people out there that I'm sure there's things that are ripping time open all the time. It's just a matter of, is it big enough to affect anything? I mean, who knows? I just know that it's a lot of fun to play with.
It is indeed. So, we are at the top of the show, and very soon I'm going to be playing, because it's Easter, and everybody's with their families, Frank's asked me to replay Saturday's morning show, plus one of their Stellar group, so... I'll be able to eat my dinner now.
Well, again, I enjoyed the story. I appreciate it. I'm glad you read it into the book. Read the book. Mm. I'm gonna read it, as a matter of fact. Listen to it.
Yeah, I played it all on the show on the station last night. I'll probably do the same thing tonight. If anybody wants a nice nightmare. Ridden sleep lullaby story.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So it's quite an exciting novel. There's love and there's war and there's death and there's weird, and you know, it's got everything for everybody. Of course there's time traveling Nazis. You know, what could be better?
And the indication was that Hitler hasn't gotten here yet.
That's what they said. Hitler didn't die. He hasn't reappeared yet. And people have seen, you know, there are pictures of Hitler in Argentina. Yeah. You know that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, there's been pictures of him in Argentina. He's supposed to live on some island out in Fuji or someplace, you know.
That's right.
It's like he's all over the place.
And
the guy was half dead at the time. I mean, I'm sorry. Unless he did some time traveling, he didn't live very long. You know, he was ravaged by disease.
Mm.
And all those cocktails of drugs his doctor was giving him. I mean, good Lord. No wonder he... You know, well, but I don't think... I don't. You know, who cares? As long as he's not standing up there ranting and raving and having people follow him, you know, I don't care where he shows up. I don't think... Yeah, you have to be the right person at the right time. He was... And I don't think, I hope we never see that time again. It needs somebody like him.
Yeah. Okay, my love.
Thank you, Barrel. Happy Easter.
thank you very much, and happy Easter to you and your people, and happy Easter to everybody and everybody's peoples. And well, I'll see you live tomorrow. I'll be producing Strange Universe with Sean, and then I'll have Journeys with JP. Probably we'll have an extended deglocker. I mean, we're really going to drill down into this. We'll see what's going on. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks, Nancy. God bless you.